Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. As humans have grown into our place on this planet, we've gained numbers, technology, and comfort, among other things. But what we've lost has often gone unnoticed. Dwindling habitat and biodiversity threaten not only the plants and animals lost, but the sustainability of human life, too. Our place is deeply interconnected. Here's Greg Meyer.
Welcome to our place. Welcome to planet Earth. It's the only place we've got, and this place of ours is in trouble. It's in trouble because we've been treating it as if it were only our place and that we don't have to take care of it in order for it to take care of us. But no, it doesn't work that way. It's time for us to learn a place within this place of ours. And it isn't only responsible or a good idea, it is vital. The way we human beings are using the planet is unsustainable. And it is destroying the many other things that find life here and have as much claim to do so as we do. And as that happens, we're also destroying what makes our lives possible. It's time for us to learn our place within this place of ours. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the fact that this planet of ours is both finite and it is one. That means we human beings need to move from living as if we were apart from the rest of the world to being part of all things. We also talked about the fact that the action needed to address the issues facing us doesn't successfully spring from awareness alone. We must go through the step of appreciation. We need to care. Knowledge alone makes us feel guilty or paralyzed. It just doesn't sustain itself. We probably need a little pushing and urging, but most of all, we need to be drawn forward by love for what we are part of. Last week, we talked about the climate ultimatum that is upon us. The planet is warming at a rate unknown in the last 10,000 years, and as the clock ticks, the needed change increases and the time to act shrinks. So we talked about how positive change happens and how we can be part of both the micro and the macro changes that need to take place. Each week, we're looking at how the needed change is both essential and it is possible. It's easy to lose hope when we face an unknown future, but there's plenty of reason to have hope. We underestimate the potential of what we can do together and of what unknown possibilities wait for us in the future. We also fail to realize the way of being in the world that we need to reclaim is not only acceptable, it's actually going to be preferable. Sure, it's different from what we're used to, but it reunites us to all things so that we can fully belong. It connects us rather than separating us from what is giving us life. The changes will benefit us and future generations. Today, now, we're going to be looking at another aspect of our place that needs us to find our place. It is the collapse of global habitats and biodiversity. We see the loss of habitats, that is, lands not converted to serve only human purposes. We see it in the precipitous decline of such land. Only 80 years ago, such land comprised 2/3 of all the land on our planet. Today, it is barely 1/3. That happened in the span of one lifetime. In terms of biodiversity, there's also an alarming loss. Since the mid-20th century, we've lost 90%, that's 90% of the large fish in our oceans. At the same time, we've lost 1/2 of all wild animals, and we've lost 25% of insects in just the last 30 years. Many species and even groups of species have disappeared entirely, and losses in both habitat and biodiversity are accelerating, not slowing down. Folks, this is happening because of human beings. It's happening because of us. Now, why is this a problem? Well, for one, there's just too much awe and wonder in this diversity of land and life to lose it. We need to be celebrating it, not losing it. Two, well, these plants and critters don't only exist for us. They have their own lives and deserve their place on this planet just like we do. And if those two reasons aren't enough, well, then number three, we need them. Whether we see it or understand it all, we depend on them. They are part of the complex web of relationships that make this planet able to take care of us, to be a home for us. To use our metaphor, we are all woven into the fabric of existence together. As biodiversity and habitats that support us disappear, the fabric we rely on unravels. I watched a video a few weeks ago that felt like a parable for our time and for the potential of our future. It happened underwater, so there's no dialogue for me to share with you, but let me relate it. Several people were night diving near Hawaii among these amazing manta rays when one dolphin shows up. They noticed that one of its pectoral fins, you know, the flipper, wasn't working, and they didn't know why. But the dolphin sidled right up to one of them, who noticed a fishing hook in its side and line wrapped around the fin and even caught up in its mouth. They're shooting video, so one diver caught the whole thing as the other was caring for the dolphin. It was amazing how the dolphin patiently suspended itself right before the diver as he pulled out the hook, used a knife to cut away the line, even pulling it out of the dolphin's teeth. When he was done, he waved goodbye to the dolphin, and off it went. Now, the amazingness of an intimate experience with a dolphin in the wild like this is enough for me to share this story with you. But the reason I do is because there's a parable here. The dolphin coming to the diver seemed to be saying that the dolphin knew that this problem, a life-endangering problem, was the responsibility of these human beings. And the dolphin knew it was going to take a human being to fix it. So the dolphin went to where the responsibility and the hope laid. One more lesson here. That intimacy, the connection with the diver as if he were one of the dolphin's friends or family, it clearly stunned the diver. I know watching it, I long for that sort of connection with wild things. And the dolphin seems to be saying this. This intimacy, this being part of each other's lives, it is always available. It's you who chose to be apart from us, to separate yourself, to pit yourself against us and our world. We're waiting. Come home. Show us we can trust you with our lives and our world. We want you back. Okay, maybe that's hopelessly romantic and idealistic, but I think it's also true, as a parable, at least. If I have a message for you today, it isn't give the animals and plants back to land. It isn't quit killing and disregarding them. It's this. Come home. We don't have to be strangers, this world and us. We belong together. And that life we want, we'll find it with one another, not apart from one another. If you want to see that video, it's linked in the podcast description, or just search Dolphin Asks Diver for Help. You'll find it. You know, as a child, I was given the gift of being raised by parents who knew the outdoors. They weren't wilderness explorers, not even campers. They both grew up on farms in the early 20th century without electricity, plumbing, phones, and very little mechanization. They had to co-inhabit the land with what their families grew and the wild things that were there with them. Though they had little scientific knowledge about it, I remember them moving easily through wild places as if they felt at home. Watching them, I simply expected to feel the same, and largely I did. I remember going for walks with my mom on the edge of town picking wild asparagus or lamb's quarter for dinner. There was no such thing as just a plant or a bird. They all had names. Normally a colloquial, not scientific name, and often not even a name anyone else knew. It was what she called them. In a far from complete, but in a very satisfying way, their world was her world. One of the things I fell in love with about my wife, Chris, was a similar passion for being with and part of the world around us. We could spend hours digging through sphagnum moss for the plants and creatures hidden there with their secret lives. I remember one of the main things we did on our honeymoon at a cabin by a northern lake was collect mushrooms and make spore prints on white paper under glass bowls so that we could identify them. Yeah, I know, romantic, huh? Yeah, you know, we just wanted to know the world around us, and the more we knew, the more we loved it, and the more we wanted to know then, and then the more we wanted to protect and care for it, for its own sake. And bonus, that also drew us together. Intimacy with the non-human part of the world is so important, and it can't be skipped. But it isn't enough. It can't stop there. Something has to change because of it. Somewhere, as a species, we human beings have taken on an outsized role on this planet. We have done what no other species has ever been known to do, and that is to evade the restrictions that nature puts on it. No species can outgrow the environment that supports it, but human beings developed a trait that not only allowed them to survive, but to evade those normal restrictions. Basically, we got smart. Smart in our ability to manipulate the environment. As David Attenborough, the lifelong documentarian of life on Earth, states in his life's witness statement, A Life on Our Planet, which I will again plug that you must watch, he states that until Homo sapiens, plants and animals had to develop a new physical ability to change their lives. But for human beings, an idea could do that. And an idea could be passed on and developed from generation to generation. We were redefining what a single species could achieve. Now, we have seen the effects of that unbridled outstripping of our planet by our one species. That is the tragic loss of biodiversity and habitat that I mentioned earlier. You see, the real question today is not about how smart we are. We are smart enough to outsmart evolution and natural processes. The real question is whether we are also wise enough not to do it. We must limit ourselves, and we must be wise enough to know that the limitations we put on ourselves are limitations of our appetites, not of our fulfillment. They open the door to life that can last and be handed on from generation to generation. The wisdom needed is literally as old as the hills. All our ancestors knew it. We know it in our bones, or in our DNA, perhaps. We must only recall it, put it front and center again. The book of Genesis in the Bible, in the very first chapters, telling stories of creation, not history or science, but a poetic portrayal of our relationship with creation, those chapters have a story that you're likely familiar with. It's about the first two people, Adam and Eve. They live in the Garden of Eden, this perfect place in which they live in balance with all things, part of all things. But then they eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The temptation was to be like God. It is as if this story is documenting humanity's transcendence beyond the belt and limitations of being part of creation to having the capacity to see themselves as and to be apart from it. With that perspective, one can see the whole rest of the Bible as a struggle, then, to be wise enough to handle that knowledge and therefore ability that we have. Sounds like self-control. We talked about that 4 weeks ago. Not surprising that in the New Testament letter Galatians, the early church realized that these fruits of the Spirit, the fruit that grows on the branches of the tree planted by streams of water, put those pieces together, that fruit included self-control. Letting wisdom govern our choices and our abilities. Greek mythology was telling the same story with Pandora's box. Ever wonder what was let out of that box and what we would have to do to contain it? Robin Wall Kimmerer is a highly decorated professor of environmental science and forest biology. She's also a citizen of the Potawatomi Nation in outstate New York, and she's the author of Braiding Sweetgrass. She has inspired many with her confluence of science and her indigenous heritage. She's shown how they both tell the same stories with different languages. She writes, "If we are fully awake, a moral question arises as we extinguish the other lives around us on behalf of our own. Whether we are digging wild leeks or going to the mall, how do we consume in a way that does justice to the lives that we take?" She goes on, "In our oldest stories, we are reminded that this was a question of profound concern for our ancestors. When we rely deeply on other lives, there is an urgency to protect them. Our ancestors, who had so few material possessions, devoted a great deal of attention to this question, while we, who are drowning in possessions, scarcely give it a thought. The cultural landscape may have changed, but the conundrum has not. The need to resolve the inescapable tension between honoring life around us and taking it in order to live is part of being human." Folks, this is not a tree hugger issue. This is not a out of the goodness of our hearts conundrum. This is a welfare of humanity and life as we know it on planet Earth kind of problem. If species do collapse, the living systems around them will collapse, including ours. Certainly, Western civilization has run up against this limit many times before, and too often, we've responded to it with more smarts than with wisdom. We've kicked the can down the road, so to speak, by creating workarounds that we call solutions. They fix the problem, but they do so by furthering our apartness from the rest of the world rather than by making us more part of the world. Examples: we add chemicals to the soil when we wear the nutrients out. We dip into aquifers when the surface water isn't enough or it's too badly tainted. We clear more land for our cattle when we find the amount available isn't enough to supply our wants. But these workarounds are just that, they're workarounds. They aren't answers. We can't just keep clearing more land, pulling water from aquifers faster than they replenish, adding more and more chemicals to exhausted land. Not forever. And as David Attenborough memorably said, anything we can't do forever is by definition not sustainable. Let me be clear. Innovation and invention are still part of the solution. The challenges ahead of us will require the best and the brightest thinking. But our innovation and invention will only be part of the solution when they team up with our wisdom, when they line up with the rest of the world, not when they are over against it. One of the truths of this world that is finite and one, is that an individual part of an ecosystem can only thrive when the rest of the ecosystem thrives. That is a rule of nature that we cannot accept ourselves from. We will not continue to thrive at the expense of the rest. So, how do we go forward? How do we heal the ecosystems that we rely on for life? How do we restore the habitats and biodiversity of our planet? Well, first of all, we do it by realizing that it can be done. Look at the rebounding of whale populations that were at near extinction numbers just 40 years ago. Wolves and bald eagles, they were also nearly gone, and while their populations are still sensitive, they have become common. We've seen what happens when we reintroduced wildlife corridors, and David Attenborough documents what happened at Chernobyl, that city in Ukraine that had to be abandoned overnight because of an accident at the nuclear facility there. In the 30 years since, the forest not only has reclaimed the city, but wildlife that is rare in the surrounding region, has become common there. That happened because of an accident. What if we intentionally created such spaces? We can also do something by just getting outside. Get outside and learn to love the world around you. Don't just use it. Richard Louv, award-winning author who one of my nature-loving kids, Amanda in this case, introduced me to, he wrote a book, The Last Child in the Woods. That book started a global movement to reconnect children with the outdoors. He says, we cannot make the case to preserve other species unless we love them. Louv documents what he calls nature deficit disorder among children who are increasingly only exposed to human-made settings and experiences. He notes the cost it has on children's development and the cost it has to society as our lack of engagement with and empathy for the rest of the world continues to degrade the environment that we rely on. This is the appreciation part of the awareness, appreciation, action cycle. Appreciating aspects of the world, recognizing and being thankful for the part they play in the ecosystems that support a life, that doesn't mean you have to like it all. It does mean, though, that you have to care about it. I'll still slap the mosquito that lands on me, but I can't wish that those mosquitoes didn't exist because I love the larger world that they are a building block of. Getting your child and yourself out of doors doesn't mean going to the Boundary Waters or off to Yosemite. The world is alive and it's at work as close as that crack in the sidewalk just outside your door. You just need to get out there with all that stuff that has been out there doing all that stuff you have no idea about all along and get to know it. When we do get out of doors, you notice that another thing starts happening that helps reverse the trends of disappearing habitat and biodiversity. You begin to blur the difference between the wild and the tame. And that's essential. You see, we seem to have this need to make spaces fit our human purposes. We tame them. And that has caused us to take spaces away from other life so that we can have them for ourselves. That has had devastating effects on habitats and therefore other living things. We relegate wild plants and animals to islands of undeveloped land. Undeveloped is an interesting term, isn't it? As if the destiny of everything on our planet is for us to have to change it for our purposes, and that is what we call development? Well, I digress. But the point is that we want wild stuff to stay on undeveloped land that we let sit around like islands in the midst of all of our development. And after all, you know, we know our territory. Certainly, they should know theirs and stay there. But plants and animals, they recognize no political or community boundaries. They need connected places to live. There are two ways to give them more, better connected wildlands. One is to return more land to wild space. That's a good idea. We should do that. But there is another and easier way we can accomplish that at the same time. And it's something that we ourselves can do. And that is to blur the line between wild and tame. Your manicured lawn looks beautiful to you, but it is a desert to wildlife. Its shallow-rooted grass doesn't hold, let alone build up the soil. Its monoculture of plants means that the bees and other pollinators who rely on spaces like your lawn to find the food that they need, they're going to go hungry. Did you know that every fall, your yard is trying to rewild itself and make room for more abundant and varied life? And it is likely that you unwild it, like almost everyone else, without even knowing it, and you do it by raking up the fallen leaves. What you may not be aware of, nor appreciate, is that those leaves were your tree's attempt at feeding themselves by taking the nutrients they produced over the summer and depositing them on the ground to return to the soil so that they can be used again. When you rake that all up and send it away, you are starving your trees. And it isn't just your trees. Those leaves are home to a host of creatures that rely on them to make it through the winter. And in return, they help process the leaves into soil so that they can be used by what grows in it. Fun critters, you know, like slugs and centipedes and beetles and spiders and butterflies. Yeah, butterflies, sure. Monarchs go south each winter, but most of them stay right here. Where do you think they stay? So we unwild our yard's attempt to rewild itself and turning its thriving diversity into something that is environmentally barren. Now, when you learn these creatures are there in your leaf litter, don't just know it. Get on your belly in your yard and find them. If you've got kids, take them with you. There is so much going on right outside your door that you probably have no idea is there. Did you know that mice and shrews and voles have tunnels beneath the snow running throughout the grassy areas near you? Find them. Get to know your neighbors. Be amazed by them and what you didn't know was going on around you all the time. They are doing it all as their part of the world around them. It is their part in keeping the ecosystem going. How's that for a homework assignment for you this week? Go for it. Tell us and tell others what you find. Take some pictures. Now, those places, they are wilderness. Even if they are only square meters and you walk past them, hardly noticing them every day. And we human beings, we've got an uncomfortable relationship with wilderness that we've got to come to grips with. We have a strange relationship of loving it and trying to eliminate it. Wilderness is also a common theme in the Bible. It reflects the same ambivalence. In the Bible, wilderness is the untouched, untamed places. That means it can be a scary place, but it is also the place people go for discernment, to discover themselves. The wilderness is where Israel spent 40 years becoming a people after escaping slavery. It is where Jesus went to discover who he was and what his calling was as he started his ministry. Wilderness is the same today. It is a place that is out of our comfort zone. It should be. It's wild. Stuff happens there that's out of our control. But wilderness is also a place we need. It is where a part of ourselves resides. And if we don't know the wilderness, we don't know our whole selves. Work with city, state, and national entities to set aside more wild areas. We need them. But it can't just be up to them. There's stuff that we can do. You can find ways that your own yard or the land at your cabin, if you're lucky enough to have it, could serve not only you, but allow other things to thrive as well. See if your apartment manager will go with this. Who knows? And this doesn't mean that you can't have a lawn, but it may mean planting a different kind of lawn, and that will look a little different. I think that can be okay. I've got trouble imagining people being more upset by a somewhat less tidy lawn than the fact that our concept of a good lawn is contributing to collapse of bee populations that we need to pollinate the fruits and vegetables that we eat. Blending the wild with your tame also doesn't mean that you just let any and every tree seedling grow up around your house or your apartment building. The forest doesn't let everything grow up either. But it does mean that you would allow a diversity of trees and shrubs and other plants so that they have a place and can give a home to other forms of life. And yes, you can learn what ones you want and plant those. There is amazing diversity in this world of ours, and that means there are lots of good choices. So, blur the line between the wild and the tame. You'll enjoy it, and the world will breathe easier. Another way you can also reverse the downward trends of habitat and biodiversity is at your dinner table. This gets back to that self-control theme. Letting a little wisdom and love for the rest of the planet condition what we would like or what we are in the habit of. One of the reasons we are losing so much wild land and the biodiversity that lives there is that we're making room for the animals that we raise to eat. As many researchers have pointed out, there's a reason why there are very few carnivores for every herbivore in the world. It's because it requires a lot of herbivores to feed each meat eater, and it requires a lot of land to feed each herbivore. When we've got 7 billion plus meat eaters on the planet, we just plain run out of room. And so do all the plants, animals, and insects who also need that room. It isn't that you can't eat any meat, but as a society, we need to eat a lot less. We can also eat more responsibly grown produce. Input-intensive crops, that is, plants that we can only get to grow by adding a lot of fertilizer or a lot of herbicides and pesticides to protect them, they're also robbing the world of the biodiversity it needs to be healthy. If you have the ability to pay extra for responsibly grown food, then you are not only getting better food for yourself, but your dollars are votes in that direction, increasing the demand for those foods, which drives down the price, which helps replace less responsibly grown foods, and gets their price within reach of people with less privilege. Vote for habitat. Vote for biodiversity. Vote for it at the ballot box, with your dollars, and with your voice. Let others know and help them appreciate what it is that you are doing and why. Okay, so here's the deal. I looked it up, and it is estimated that there are at least 350,000 species of just beetles living in our place with us. That's a lot. It means that the world likes variety. And not just some variety, but wild, unimaginable, breathtaking variety. If you want to talk about God this way, it means that God likes that kind of variety. And it means that something in how the world works relies on the same kind of grand, mind-bending variety. Yet, we human beings are turning it into a world of homogeneity, taking away the myriad tools in the tool belt of nature that's needed to keep our world working. And that doesn't work. It isn't sustainable. And it isn't distant generations that are going to feel it. The weight of our overexercise of want and underexercise of wisdom will fall on people living right now on planet Earth. While it is too late to just fix this problem and have it go away, species that are extinct are gone. Painful changes in the Earth's habitats are already set in motion. Nonetheless, this planet is powerful and it's dynamic. Life is resilient and endlessly creative, and given space, species and habitats rebound shockingly quickly. It is happening all around us. It is within our ability to make space for our fellow passengers on planet Earth. I'm optimistic, as I am determined, because we human beings aren't only smart and stubborn, we are also capable of wisdom and have an enormous capacity for love. We can choose to live as part of this world rather than apart from it. And we can recognize that is how we have always found our place here. We can realize our wholeness, our happiness, our delight. It comes from being part of, not apart from, our neighbors. You know, over and over again, Jesus said, love one another. It's an appropriate thing to say in so many situations because it is so often exactly what is needed. Love this world we have been given to share in. If we take care of it, our place, it shall take care of us.
Thanks for listening. Maybe sharing this podcast will help you start an important conversation with someone in your life. You can find discussion resources and ways to connect on our website, fabricmpls.com. Discovering our place is something we'll need to do together, and that movement toward wholeness and interconnection of self, other people, the natural world, and the divine is how we talk about life woven deeply.